Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, let's start off with the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all things wonderful in the world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up from the Dayton Daily News, Ohio to spend $4.1 million on initiatives aimed to fight youth vaping. Dr. Amy Acton, Director of the Ohio Department of Health, announced $4.1 million in new initiatives to prevent youth vaping. The explosive increase in vaping among our youth is a public health crisis, and we must educate them and their parents about the dangers of vaping, Acton said. Youth have shown an increased vulnerability to nicotine addiction, and evidence suggests that nicotine use during adolescence and young adulthood has long-term impacts on brain development. State and local public health officials in Ohio have confirmed that 10 reports of severe pulmonary illness are likely due to vaping and are investigating an additional 14 reports of illness. In 33 states, the CDC says that it's aware of more than 450 possible cases of severe pulmonary illness after vaping and 6 deaths. There's no single product or device linked to all the cases of lung disease. Some, but not all, reported recent use of products containing THC, a chemical in marijuana. Both vaping industry officials and the CDC warned against using modified products or e-cigarette products bought off the street. While recent illness reports fueled the conversation, public health officials have been emphasizing concerns that predate the mystery lung disease, that teens are getting hooked on vaping. Juul Labs, one of the makers of e-cigarettes, grew its products with the help of marketing campaigns where young adults with large numbers of followers promoted their products. Critics and public health officials have said this strategy of making their product look cool and youthful fueled an alarming rise in teen vaping. The number of Ohio teens who smoke cigarettes has declined dramatically over the last 20 years, and public health officials are worried that the rise in vaping is undoing their hard work. Nationally, last year there was a 48% rise in vaping among middle schoolers and a 78% increase in vaping among high schoolers, though those numbers aren't available yet at the state level. The DeWine administration has already worked on several initiatives to curb teen vaping. This includes raising the purchase age to 21 starting October 17th and placing an excise tax on e-cigarettes, which in the past were not subject to an excise tax. Raising the price of tobacco through an excise tax is an evidence-based way to reduce consumption. Acton said that besides these efforts, these recently announced funds will be used for social media outreach to combat the social media messages that promoted vaping. The newly announced effort from the administration includes letters to schools encouraging them to prohibit the use of vaping products and to warn about the dangers of vaping and where to get free help to quit. About $3.3 million is to develop and promote community education resources so groups and parents can take action, and about $800,000 in public education campaigns target youth and their parents about vaping. While there's decades of research on what works to reduce smoking, widespread teen vaping is a relatively new phenomenon, and there are still some new questions on what works best to help kids quit. The science is trying to keep up with this big experiment that's being done on our kids, Acton said. Acton said one thing that is concerning about vaping is that when people vape by heating oils to a high temperature, those oils cool and can coat the lungs and prevent the flow of oxygen. That's why we are saying avoid it. And you can't say avoid it if you don't have a way to for people addicted to stop, she said. And on that line, the Ohio Tobacco Quit Line. Call the Ohio Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW anytime for help quitting smoking or the use of other tobacco products, including e-cigarettes. A quit coach leads a counseling session during your first call. There are a total of 5 scheduled sessions. You can choose to have nicotine patches, gum, or lozenges sent directly to your home free of charge for everyone in the state. Someone will also call in about 7 months to check in, and you can call anytime for extra help. Again, that number is 1-800-QUIT-NOW, the Ohio Tobacco Quit Line, for your use and those of your loved ones. Okay, next up from the Hill. Sexual trauma is a global public health issue. A recent study published in one of the premier journals of the American Medical Association indicates that 6.5% of women in the United States experience their first sexual intercourse through physical force or coercion. Using a population-based sample of over 13,000 American women between the ages of 18 and 44 and appropriate statistical weighting, researchers say this means that more than 3.3 million reproductive age women nationwide experience forced intercourse as their sexual initiation. That number is jaw-dropping. As a trauma psychologist, this to me further highlights the imperative for public health measures and sociocultural changes to prevent sexual violence. Until recently, a lot of the research on forced sexual initiation was conducted outside the U.S. This new investigation, however, definitively shows that forced sexual initiation happens here as well. In addition, this study documents that those who experience their first sexual encounter as forced have serious subsequent negative health consequences, including reproductive and gynecologic issues. These women are more likely to develop painful pelvic conditions, such as inflammatory diseases or endometriosis, experience unwanted first pregnancies or abortions, and have problems with ovulation or menstruation. Coerced or forced sexual initiation in women has also been associated with higher rates of HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, and intercourse with multiple and high-risk sexual partners. It should also be no secret after the Me Too movement that sexual violence, including sexual harassment and non-penetrative sexual assault and rape, is highly linked to serious mental health outcomes. This includes, but is not limited to, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, substance abuse, eating disorders, and suicidal thoughts and behaviors. It's not alarmist to say that forced sexual initiation and other forms of sexual violence can affect girls and women for the rest of their lives. It affects how they see themselves and how they expect others to treat them in relationships. Dr. Nicole Nugent, an internationally recognized child clinical psychologist and associate professor at Brown University, has worked with this population for many years. She said it breaks your heart to hear their stories. Girls who have been sexually violated say things like, "I'm dirty and no one will ever want to date or marry me." I've seen many of these girls pick unhealthy dating partners in their futures because they believe they are not deserving of being with a good and kind person. Dr. Nugent further explained, some of these girls have a very hard time believing that forced sexual initiation was rape. They say things like, I didn't want to lose my virginity that way. It's not uncommon that their perceptions about this traumatic experience become twisted in their mind. Sexual violence is something that is hard to digest in the psyche. Its effects linger. For example, the moment someone touches them, even in a loving way, they shut down and freeze. Oftentimes, these trauma responses make it much more difficult for women to engage in safe sex negotiations and with future partners. Sadly, not having these skills or not believing the skills should be put in place almost sets women up for re-victimization. Clearly, we need to improve the physical and mental health care of women and men who have been sexually assaulted in this country. But we also desperately need public health policies and programs aimed at reducing forced sexual initiation and other forms of sexual violence across the lifespan. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has been strongly promoting the dissemination of programs that address sexual culture and violence prevention skills, it'd be prudent for our country's health systems to invest in developing and implementing evidence-informed prevention approaches. We need programs, policies, and practices that promote social norms that protect against violence, like bystander approaches. These involve people being taught to recognize behavior that puts others at risk for sexual violence, and then how to take appropriate steps to safety and effectively intervene. I wish it was easy as waving a magic wand to make the world a better place. One of the most difficult problems that I wish could quickly and easily be solved would be to positively shape relationship skills. What if we all received some really key social and emotional skills focused on empathy, conflict management, and communication at an appropriate age? What if all of us gained a firm understanding on what makes for healthy dating and marital relationships, including sharing power and respecting one another's boundaries? Wouldn't it be amazing if we were all taught the basics of healthy sexuality, and that it's normal and acceptable for women to initiate and decline sexual intercourse? This recent study illuminating the rates and some of the effects of forced sexual initiation in American women adds to the decades of research on sexual violence. Too many women and men across cultures and societies encounter sexual violence. It's a global public health issue that increases people's vulnerability to a host of physical, psychological, and social difficulties. We must do something to implement best practice interventions and policies to prevent and address this widespread problem. Okay, next up from The Intercept, war on the world. It may not come as a surprise that the largest industrial military in the history of the world is also the single biggest polluter on the planet. A recent study from Brown University's Costs of War Project surfaced this startling fact. The U.S. Department of Defense has a larger annual carbon footprint than most countries on Earth. With a sprawling network of bases and logistics networks, the U.S. military is the single biggest emitter of carbon dioxide in the world, aside from whole nation states themselves. Indeed, the Department of Defense is the world's largest institutional user of petroleum and correspondingly the single largest producer of greenhouse gases in the world. If the Pentagon were a country, it would be the world's 55th largest emitter of carbon dioxide, and its main purpose, warfare, is easily its most carbon-intensive activity. Since the present era of American conflicts began with the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, the U.S. military is estimated to have emitted a staggering 1.2 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere. For comparison, the entire annual carbon emissions of the United Kingdom is roughly 360 million tons. That massive additional burden on the planet might be justifiable were it all being done in the name of vital national security interests, but the biggest components of the U.S. military's carbon dioxide footprint have been in wars and occupations that were almost entirely unnecessary. To put it crudely, the U.S. poisoned the planet for vanity projects. In addition to emitting millions of tons of carbon dioxide during the war, the U.S. military footprint contributed more directly to the immediate destruction of the Afghan environment. Deforestation has accelerated amid the chaos of the war, and through trash burning and other means, the U.S. armed forces release toxic pollutants into the air that are blamed for sickening Afghan civilians and causing chronic illnesses among U.S. veterans. The environmental havoc wreaked by the war in Iraq has been even worse. Not only did the war lead to a spike in carbon dioxide emissions through the U.S. military activity, it resulted in the widespread poisoning of the Iraqi environment through the use of toxic munitions and the same so-called burn pits on military bases that were used in Afghanistan. The environment has become so toxic in some places that it has led to elevated rates of cancer, as well as crippling birth defects, terrible individual punishments inflicted on innocent future generations. A British doctor who co-authored two studies on the environmental impact of U.S. military operations in Fallujah said that the city's population suffers the highest rate of genetic damage in any population ever studied. Much of this impact can be blamed on the use of depleted uranium munitions by the U.S. forces. Despite vowing to cease their use, a study by the independent monitoring group Air Wars and Foreign Policy magazine found that the military continued to use the toxic munitions during its most recent bombing campaign in Syria. The fact that fossil fuel emissions have been the major driver of climate change adds another grim irony to these wars. For decades, the heavy U.S. military footprints in the Middle East has been justified by the need to preserve access to the region's oil preserves. The industrial extraction of those same reserves has been one of the major drivers of global carbon dioxide emissions. In other words, we have been killing, dying, and polluting to ensure our access to the same toxic resource most responsible for our climate disruption. It took this perfect symmetry between industrial warfare and industrial exploitation of the Earth to bring about the unspeakable emergency we now face. Ironically, given its own role in helping create this emergency, the Pentagon happens to be one of the few readouts from the climate denialism now gripping the American government. The only department in Washington that is clearly and completely seized with the idea that climate change is real is the Department of Defense, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former chief and staff to General Colin Powell, has said. The U.S. military is preparing for a grim future of climate-caused political instability, food shortages, resource wars, and massive refugee flows. Recognizing the strategic threat posed by its own dependence on fossil fuel, it has even taken steps to diversify its energy sources. Yet even these limited efforts have met pushback from the Trump administration. The Navy recently killed a task force created to study the effects of climate change, undermining a bare minimum effort to forecast the impact of rising seas and melting ice caps. In the words of the former Rear Admiral who led the Navy's climate change efforts until 2015, the task force ended, in my opinion, without full incorporation of climate change considerations. The melting of the Arctic is not just creating an ecological emergency, but in the eyes of American, Russian, and Chinese military commanders, it is also creating a potential new battleground. Faced with a planet that is clearly at the limits of the abuse it can take, the groundwork is still being laid for more exploitation and violence. Okay, and sticking with the theme of the Defense Department, this from MLive.com, 15 U.S. governors lobby for provisions on toxic chemicals in defense bill. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine and 14 other U.S. state governors are lobbying Congress to include provisions that would establish strong national regulations around pollution from chemicals called PFAS in the latest must-pass defense bill. The September 18th letter, signed by 4 Republican and 11 Democratic governors, urged the U.S. Senate and House Armed Services Committees to include multiple PFAS-related provisions in the final version of the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2020. The issue is being tied to defense spending in part because of the military's lengthy and widespread use of PFAS in firefighting foam, a practice that has caused contamination at more than 400 U.S. defense facilities around the world. The governors note that several U.S. states have already or are presently developing their own state-specific laws on PFAS in the absence of enforceable national standards. PFAS are a large group of industrial chemicals, highly prized for their durability and power to repel water, grease, and withstand high temperatures. The chemistry has been used in products, things like food packaging, Teflon nonstick cookware, Scotch Guard fabric protector, and firefighting foams. In the decades since the initial development, PFAS chemicals have contaminated the groundwater, soil, and surface waters of many states. Exposure to the chemicals has been linked in human studies to certain cancers, thyroid malfunction, and other chronic diseases. The advocacy nonprofit Environmental Working Group estimates the chemicals have been found in 712 sites in 49 states. If designated as hazardous substances under the federal Superfund law, the EPA would have greater authority to order and enforce cleanups at PFAS-contaminated sites, as well as recover remediation costs from polluters. Okay, and sticking with the environmental theme, this from Inside Climate News. Deforestation is getting worse 5 years after countries and companies vowed to stop it. 5 years after joining in a historic commitment to stop cutting the world's forests, governments and companies are not only failing to slow deforestation, they are rapidly driving the disappearance of more trees. As fires consume Amazonian forests, stoking global concern about the loss of a vital ecosystem and climate regulator, a new report finds that forests continue to be cleared at an alarming rate, driven mostly by agricultural expansion and demand for beef, palm oil, and soy. "We're losing the battle, so to speak, on stopping deforestation," said Craig Hansen, a vice president at the World Resources Institute. "This is a clarion call." Nearly 200 companies and governments have signed onto the 2014 New York Declaration on Forests, which includes the goals of halving deforestation by 2020 and stopping it by 2030. but the new assessment by researchers and environmental groups found that forest loss has accelerated by more than 40% annually since the declaration's launch. The cutting and burning of tropical forests, especially mature tropical forests, is particularly damaging because of the carbon storage lost and the contribution to climate change when trees burn or decompose. They found that on average, tropical deforestation and tree deaths emitted more carbon dioxide per year in the past 5 years than the entire European Union did in 2017. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has said the world won't achieve critical emissions reduction goals without stopping deforestation and restoring world's forests. Okay, and with the climate change issue, another issue with public health, this from publicintegrity.org, man versus mosquito at the front lines of a public health war. Mosquito-borne illnesses like Zika have increased almost tenfold nationally from 2004 to 2016, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That's put local governments at the front lines of a contentious public health war, one that climate change will only worsen. A 2016 report by Climate Central found warming temperatures coupled with more humid days having elongated mosquito seasons. The insect's range has also expanded. Aedes aegypti, the species that transmits Zika, dengue, yellow fever, and chikungunya, has moved northward in the U.S. by roughly 150 miles per year. By 2050, researchers predict almost half the world's population will be exposed to at least one of two major disease-carrying mosquitoes. Scientists are also concerned about the growing threat of resistance, which undercuts the effectiveness of insecticides. Mosquitoes are not a new enemy. Historian Timothy Weingart estimated in a 2019 book that the winged insects have killed more than 52 billion people, making them humanity's deadliest predator, with far more casualties than all recorded wars combined. Malaria, now seen as a mostly tropical disease, was rampant in the U.S. until a federal program run by an early version of the CDC eliminated the illness domestically by 1951. That program made heavy use of DDT, a now banned insecticide that is toxic to mosquitoes, but also to birds, bees, and humans. Today, the Herculean task of managing and tracking mosquitoes falls largely to local mosquito control districts. These little-known entities can operate as standalone agencies funded through special taxes or as divisions within health or agricultural departments. Vast differences in budgets, scientific expertise, and policy mean mosquito control in the U.S. can vary widely from one location to the next. Districts also have to strike a tough balance between safeguarding communities and weighing concerns from environmentalists about the ecological impacts of insecticides. But districts hampered by a lack of resources and authority may be unable to do much beyond spraying, and only after an infection is detected. We need to the help of politicians and public health officials to recognize our job is not response, it's prevention. And one note with that, for those of you in Lucas County, here in Toledo, we do have what's considered a more advanced and better funded mosquito control district. Although when that thing comes buzzing by your street, you hear that thing letting out that fog of insecticide, you might want to close your windows. Okay, next up from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. What's the connection between residential segregation and health? Residential segregation is a fundamental cause of health disparities. We need to take steps that will reduce health risks caused by segregation and lead to more equitable, healthier communities. For some, perhaps the mere mention of segregation suggests the past, a shameful historic moment we have moved beyond. But the truth is, residential segregation, especially the separation of whites and blacks or Hispanics in the same community, continues to have lasting implications for the well-being of people of color and the health of the entire community. In many U.S. counties and cities, neighborhoods with little diversity are the daily reality. When neighborhoods are segregated, so too are schools, public services, jobs, and other kinds of opportunities that affect health. We know that in communities where there are more opportunities for everyone, there is better health. The 2016 County Health Rankings, released recently, provide a chance for every community to take a hard look at whether everyone living there has an opportunity for health and well-being. The rankings look at many interconnected factors that influence community health, including education, jobs, smoking, physical inactivity, and access to health care. This year, we added a new measure on residential segregation to help communities see where disparities may cluster, because some neighborhoods or areas have been cut off from opportunities and investments that fuel good health. The effects of residential segregation are often stark. Blacks and Hispanics who live in highly segregated and isolated neighborhoods have lower housing quality, higher concentrations of poverty, and less access to good jobs and education. As a consequence, they experience greater stress and have a higher risk of illness and death. Although there are pockets of high residential segregation scattered across the country, residential segregation of blacks and whites appears highest in the Northeast and Great Lakes region and lowest among the southeastern seaboard. Okay, next up from Stat News, from Dr. Brian Barnett, MD, an addiction psychiatrist at Cleveland's Clinic Lutheran Hospital. National support for red flag laws could prevent many suicides. Red flag gun laws, which allow for the temporary removal of guns from individuals at high risk of harming themselves or others, have broad public backing but haven't yet gained national traction. Opponents have voiced concern about the potential overreach or abuse of such laws. In states that already have them, only 0.02% to 0.04% of gun owners have been affected, demonstrating that these fears are unfounded. And just as an editorial note, if you want to know about gun owners being affected, actually this 0.02 to 0.04% is actually lower than the number of gun owners who actually kill themselves. Okay. While mass shootings may have motivated the introduction of legislation, its potential benefits go far beyond their realm. Although such shootings are increasing in frequency and deadliness, they thankfully remain rare. In 2018, they claimed the lives of 373 people, with 313 deaths so far this year. In contrast, more than 47,000 Americans died from suicide, and 1.4 million attempted it in 2017, the last year for which complete data is available. Suicide is our country's 10th leading cause of death, and its frequency is increasing. Americans are 2.5 times more likely to take their own lives than to be murdered. Any death is tragic, but suicide is particularly so because it is often impulsive. Most people who attempt suicide and survive regret making the attempt, and 70% never try again. Remarkably, firearms are used in only 6% of suicide attempts, but cause more than half of all suicide deaths. Due to their destructive power, approximately 85% of suicide attempts involving firearms end in death. Their involvement in suicide attempts is also rising. Red flag gun laws have been shown to reduce firearm suicide rates, with one suicide averted for every 10 to 20 gun removals. I often treat patients who have been hospitalized because they are suicidal or have survived a suicide attempt. They are usually stabilized with therapy and medications and discharged back into their communities within a week. But before that happens, I must figure out what to do when such individuals have one or more guns at home, since the rate of suicide following discharge is 30 times higher than in the general population. The longer that guns can be removed, the better, since approximately half of post-charge suicides occur within 6 months of discharge. While red flag gun laws might prevent some mass shootings, they would spare many, many more lives from suicide. That impact would be greatly magnified if mental health providers were allowed to play a more active role in our nation's safety. Next up, from the Food Politics blog by Marion Nessel. Weekend reading, The State of Obesity. Trust for America's Health has just published its annual report on obesity, state by state. As the homepage puts it, U.S. obesity rates reach historic highs. Racial, ethnic, gender, and geographic discrepancies continue to persist. The press release has an even more pointed headline. U.S. obesity rates at historic highs. 9 states reach adult obesity rates of 35% or more. The report highlights that obesity levels are closely tied to social and economic conditions, and that individuals with lower incomes are more at risk. People of color, who are more likely to live in neighborhoods with few options for healthy foods and physical activity, and are the target of widespread marketing of unhealthy foods, are at elevated risk. What to do? The report calls for sugary drink taxes, expanded SNAP and WIC nutrition support programs, and a built environment that encourages physical activity. Buried in the report are suggestions for curbing food industry marketing and other efforts to undermine public health initiatives. Keep industry out of dietary guidelines. Consider regulating food industry marketing. Stop industry from preempting state public health laws and reduce unhealthy food marketing to children. Okay, sticking on the nutrition theme, From Science Daily, despite growing burden of diet-related diseases, medical education does not equip students to provide high-quality nutritional care to patients. Worldwide, nutrition is insufficiently incorporated into medical education, meaning that medical students lack the confidence, skills, and knowledge to provide nutritional care to patients, according to a systematic review of 24 studies published in the Lancet Planetary Health Journal. The authors recommend that nutrition education be made compulsory for all medical students, a global benchmark on the required level of nutritional knowledge for future doctors be established, and more funding be put towards developing new ways to teach nutrition in medical school. Globally, 11 million deaths annually are attributable to poor diet, making it the leading risk factor for death across the world. Accordingly, many countries recommend that doctors apply nutrition knowledge in practice to support patients to manage lifestyle-related, chronic disease, and other diet-related conditions. However, these findings suggest that nutrition in medical education is lacking in all countries studied. The reviewed studies consistently found that medical students want to receive nutrition education to develop their skills in nutrition care, but perceived that their education did not equip them to do so. Students cited both quantity and quality of their education as reasons for this, poor quality and under-prioritization of nutrition in the curriculum, lack of interest and expertise in nutrition among faculty members, and few examples of nutritional counseling during clinical years to serve as models for emerging doctors. Furthermore, students uniformly report having a lack of required nutrition knowledge, which was also found through testing. For instance, one study found that when nutrition knowledge was assessed in a test, half of medical students scored below the pass rate. The authors underlined that ongoing inadequate nutrition education identified in their study is likely to affect the standard of care doctors are providing to patients, not least in preventative care. Therefore, they stress the importance of institutional commitments to making nutrition education compulsory in medical training through accreditation standards and establishing benchmarks and nutritional knowledge needed by doctors before graduation. Now on to a quick story from The Hill on healthcare. House panel investigating private equity firms' role in surprise medical bills. The bipartisan leaders of the House Energy and Commerce Committees are launching an investigation into what role private equity firms may play in the problem of patients getting stuck with massive surprise medical bills. Hospitals sometimes contract out the staffing of their emergency room or other departments to these physician staffing companies, who then can send massive bills to patients because the staffing company might not be in their insurance network, even though the hospital as a whole is. The New York Times reported that two large physician staffing companies owned by some of these private equity firms are helping to fund millions of dollars in ads against the legislation on surprise medical bills. These guys are making a lot of money off the backs of patients who are playing by the rules to the best of their ability. Lawmakers are mostly trying to overcome industry opposition to get the legislation passed, not a partisan divide, given that both parties largely agree on this issue. This is a perfect example of the profit motive and how a fragmented healthcare system does not work for patients. Okay, let's end on some good news, though. This from the World Health Organization. More women and children survive today than ever before, UN report. More women and their children are surviving today than ever before, according to new child and maternity mortality estimates released by the United Nations group led by UNICEF and the World Health Organization. Since 2000, child deaths have reduced by nearly half and maternal deaths by over one-third, mostly due to improved access to affordable quality health services. In countries that provide everyone with safe, affordable, high-quality health services, women and babies survive and thrive, said Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, Director General of World Health Organization. This is the power of universal health coverage. Still, the new estimates reveal that 6.2 million children under 15 died in 2018, and over 290,000 women died due to complications during pregnancy and childbirth. Of the total child deaths, 5.3 million occurred in the first 5 years, with almost half of these in the first month of life. Women and newborns are most vulnerable during and immediately after childbirth. An estimated 2.8 million pregnant women and newborns die every year, or one every 11 seconds, mostly of preventable causes. Children face the highest risk of dying in the first month, especially if they are born too soon or too small, have complications during birth, congenital defects, or contract infections. About a third of those deaths occur within the first day and nearly three quarters in the first week alone. Around the world, birth is a joyous occasion, yet every 11 seconds a birth is a family tragedy, said Henrietta Fiore, UNICEF executive director. A skilled pair of hands to help mothers and newborns around the time of birth, along with clean water, adequate nutrition, basic medicines and vaccines, can make the difference between life and death. We must do all it takes to invest in universal health coverage to save these precious lives. The estimates also show vast inequalities worldwide, with women and children in sub-Saharan Africa facing a substantially higher risk of death than all other regions. Levels of maternal death are nearly 50 times higher for women in sub-Saharan Africa, and their babies are 10 times more likely to die in the first month of life compared to high-income countries. From 2000 to 2017, the maternal mortality ratio declined by 38%. Southern Asia has made the greatest improvements in maternal survival with a nearly 60% reduction. Success has been due to political will to improve access to quality health care by investing in the health workforce, introducing free care for pregnant women and children, and supporting family planning. Many of these countries focus on primary health care and universal health care coverage. For children who survive the first month, infectious diseases such as pneumonia, diarrhea, and malaria account for the most deaths globally. In older children, injuries, including road traffic injuries and drowning, become important causes of death and disability. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.